So we're going to do the McLuhan Dew Line, Volume 1, Number 3, September 1968. It started in July 68, and then there was an August 68 issue. We did those two. And this one is called A Second Way to Read War and Peace in the Global Village, which was a book that came out in August or so, 1968. So people getting this Dew Line newsletter in September probably got a copy of the book sent to them. And it's similar to the black and white book. It's a collage, but there are a lot of quotes from Finnegan's Wake. It's a lot more difficult to read. So they are offering a guide to how to encounter the book. So it's called A Second Way to Read War and Peace in the Global Village. That's the title of the book. Or McLuhan Made Linear. So they're telling you this is the linear version of McLuhan. It's not all of McLuhan, but it is the nonlinear made linear. In other words, it's put into prose and explained step by step. Okay? Any other questions? Now, there's a lot of text, so I'm just going to read through the text and stop every now and then.
Okay.
And it says this was put out by the Human Development Corporation, 119 Fifth Avenue, New York, New York. Copyright 1968, Marshall McLuhan. So I think I will mute while I read in case noise is interrupted because we want to make as good a copy of this as possible. So after 5, 10, 15 minutes, I'll stop and we'll see what you say. Okay.
All participants are now unmuted. All participants are now muted.
There's several parts. I don't know how many parts there are, but this is part one, section one, and it's going to lead into section two, but then section two has subdivisions. Okay, so section one begins a quote from Pablo Picasso, quoted by Francois Gillot and Carlton Lake in a book called Life with Picasso. So that was a book around Francois Gillot, former wife of Pablo Picasso, her memories with Pablo. And she said, quote, if he really is an artist, it is in his nature not to want to be admitted. Because if he is admitted, it can only mean that he's doing something which is understood, approved, and therefore old hat, worthless. Anything new, anything worth doing, can't be recognized. People just don't have that much vision. So Picasso, Zappa would do the same thing. If people started to like him, he'd get worried. Or if he started to get promoted and accepted in the mainstream. Ion does the same thing by saying, if you lose the leading edge and you get accepted by the mass audience, it's not good, Bob. So Ion doesn't want to be totally understood or accepted or cliche for a mass level. So the essay begins, the enclosed Bantam book, War and Peace in the Global Village, should be released on the stands just about the time you open this package. It's one of the two newest McLuhan books, the other being Through the Vanishing Point with Harley Parker, published by Harper & Row. It is given to you here not only as a free gift with your subscription to the McLuhan Dew Line, and Dew Line spelled capital D, capital E, capital W, and then Line, and it stands for the Pentagon's distant early warning system they had built in Canada's Arctic to protect people from Russian missiles. So this book is given to you here not only as a free gift with your subscription to the McLuhan Dew Line, but to serve as the basis for a brief sensory retraining program, which will be contained in this letter. There are three reasons for including this sensory retraining program at this time and in this form. They are, one, Dr. McLuhan has from time to time been criticized for his style. To give just one amusing example, here's what Benjamin DeMott said about it in the New Yorker magazine, quote, his writing is deliberately anti-logical, colon, circular, repetitious, unqualified, gnomic, outrageous, end of quote. Let me just check something. All right, so that's reason number one. Reason number two, and so it might seem, not only to the public at large, but to many readers of this newsletter, point two, to the public at large, but to many of the readers of this newsletter. In other words, his prose is difficult. The fundamental question, however, is why? Why has Dr. McLuhan chosen this particular style? Why has he spent many years deliberately developing and strengthening it? What does he seek to express with it, which he feels he cannot express in a more conventional style? And perhaps more important, is there a key to this style that will make the main ideas contained within it more immediately available to the average, and we must add, linear reader, the average linear reader? Is there a second way to read, for example, War and Peace in the Global Village that will remove much of the unfamiliarity and therefore discomfort that the average reader feels upon first encountering it without preparation? And can this same secondary approach also enable the reader to use this book and this style as an introduction to a whole new emerging human sensibility, much more widespread than Dr. McLuhan's work? 3, we believe it can. We therefore submit it for you to try yourself. We believe, in summary, that it will, first, clear up at least some of the confusion concerning Dr. McLuhan's style. Second, enable you to read War and Peace in the Gold Village and other McLuhan books in both linear and nonlinear ways. Note that, you read them in both ways. And then go on from there, if you wish, and achieve a deeper understanding of other 20th century writers such as James Joyce, T.S. Eliot, and W.B. Yeats, plus the overwhelming appeal to the young of such pop rock groups as Simon and Garfunkel or the Jefferson Airplane, plus the inevitable emergence and dominance in the industrial arena of the corporate conglomerate, all of which depend on the same structural elements as Dr. McLuhan's style. Now let us turn to an examination of these elements. So you see, he's saying his style mirrors the nonlinear reality around people, as expressed in different media, from literature to big corporations and how they run their business organization. So now we go into section 2, a quote from W.B. Yeats, an essay called An Introduction to My Plays. He says, I have spent my life in clearing out of poetry every phrase written for the eye. I have spent my life in clearing out of poetry every phrase written for the eye. Fifth says, starts off, Section 2, or let's say Part 2. 15 years ago, when McLuhan first began to publish his Canadian magazine, Explorations, that'd be 1953, his style was exactly what you would expect. It was clear and connected, linear and lucid, perfectly step-by-step. For example, so they give a quote from an essay called Classroom Without Walls from 1953. It quotes, it says, quoting it, it says, it's natural today to speak of audiovisual aids to teaching, for we still think of the book as norm, of other media as incidental. We also think of the new media, press, radio, TV, as mass media, and think of the book as an individualistic form. Individualistic because it isolated the reader in silence and helped create the Western eye, the capital I. Yet it was the first product of mass production. End of quote. So the editor says, you will immediately realize that Dr. McLuhan is dealing here with much the same material as is contained in his later works. In other words, in 1953, it's repeated, that theme from 53 in his later works. Yet the style is completely different, meaning later. And yet the style is completely different. The parallel with Picasso is perfect. Dr. McLuhan's early style is as conventional and as easy to take as Picasso's paintings of clowns and lovers in the blue and pink periods. Picasso began to change his style almost imperceptibly in 1906. McLuhan began to change his even more imperceptibly in 1954. In that year, he published two articles, one in Poetry magazine, called Poetry, the other in Commonweal magazine. The point in each being loosely that linear visual poetry, one line at a time, one idea at a time, was being supplanted by a literature of total impact based on sound and compound impressions. Let us carry the analogy one step further. For 7 years after 1906, almost unknown to the world and certainly to America, Picasso developed and intensified his new style. When it exploded on the world in the Armory Show in New York in 1913, it was full-blown and almost indecipherable. The only name that the stunned critics could give to it was actually based on a misreading of both its intent and function. It was called Cubism, Cubism in quotes. What this new style did was quite simple. It abandoned completely the fixed perspective that, until that time, had dominated painting. It no longer looked at the still life or the sitter from one vantage point and no other. Instead, it walked around the sitter, examining him from all angles at once and presenting them all at the exact same instant on the canvas. The Cubist style was therefore a break with the old linear visual painting and its replacement by a painting of total impact based on all-at-onceness and I'll do that again. The Cubist style was, therefore, a break with the old linear visual painting and its replacement by a painting of total impact based on all at onceness and compound impressions. Many patrons of the Armory Show in 1913 said that Picasso couldn't paint till they saw the works of the earlier blue and pink periods. In the same way today, many critics say that Dr. McLuhan can't write when they have never even seen the earlier issues of Explorations in the 50s. In both cases, Picasso's and McLuhan's, it is simply the abandonment of an old style for a new one and the adamant refusal to return to an outdated mode that the world has passed by. Now, what was Dr. McLuhan trying to do when he exploded full-blown on the world in 1962 with the Gutenberg Galaxy, and again in 1964 with Understanding Media, and again today with War and Peace in the Global Village? What are the elements that have entered his style, then dominated and transformed it? Okay, we will unmute.
All participants are now unmuted.
At this point?
Yes, it's what we were talking about, these outdated models and ideas.
Right.
I get an echo. Yes, like many people say, Picasso is just like children drawing.
Yeah.
Or they were, because they were not getting McLuhan, they thought he was just talking nonsense when he said, for example, we can program the environment. It's like, what? They could not even start to see.
And McLuhan is
how could that be possible?
Right. And McLuhan's saying that he was reflecting the present, and the people didn't live in the present. They lived a phase back.
Yes, and as you explained to me, programming the environment was already done by the Egyptians. That was their program to.
That was the Pharaoh's
program.
To program
the environment with the. Yeah, their whole visual space, which is actually how you are educated by
right.
The environment hitting you from all sides.
Well, they weren't programming as visual space. They were programming visual space among all the spaces, like Orpheus, who tuned the world. Orpheus, the Greek god, who used music to tune and program the whole world. So it's not a visual methodology.
Right, and he also talks about this nonlinear reality, which is even more extreme now that we have access to all times, all text, all information instantly. And we can transform, share, and do whatever we want to do with this information almost instantly.
We can do it instantly. Bert, do you have anything to say? Or anybody
else? I found the reference to the linear, nonlinear ways very interesting to do an explanation of what he was doing in the comparison to Picasso, that he was repeating what he did in the 1950s in a different way, but he was illustrating the art form that he was using of what he did in his past references, Global Village, all his other references, and did it in a nonlinear way to sort of point towards what he learned or what he enjoyed with Finnegan's Wake.
Yes, and what he saw happening since television.
Yes.
And radio. Anybody else got anything to say?
Yes, and for example, the bifrontal representations of people by Picasso, he wanted to use different perspectives and at the same time, because this is what how we start to perceive the world with the movies, and like we can access other points of view, like also with planes, we can see the from above, from other
right.
other points of view that were not, or the microscopes.
And if artists registering the sensory life of a culture, the art had to change to register the new sensory impressions of movies, radio, television, cars, airplanes, the whole panoply. It's obvious, but the people of the time did not expect art to change because they didn't know they were being changed. So art had to act out the change right in front of them with much resistance. But that's the classroom there. The art world is a classroom.
You know, Bob, one thing that I always think about when you make some of these statements is Picasso is, you know, working from a point of view at that time. And I often wondered, and I'm sure you've asked Ryan this stuff, you're positioning them into a place where they're asking from their point of view from that timeline. So if they were people that were unlimited or eternal or whatever, you know, did they make a difference in how they perceived the summations that they were doing at that time? Does that make sense? You know, if they were a bit more, we're kind of slotting them into a position that is a linear timeline of how they would perceive something. If they were multidimensional, you know, is it possible that they were engaging some of what they were encountering, you know, from a different point of view, but from a more...
Yeah, you're not saying you've got to keep it shorter. What do you think you're trying to say? Translate what you said.
The people that you're talking about, like Picasso, when we're saying that he saw it this way, how do we know that?
Because there's interviews with him. He used to say, "My paintings are to make you have the effect that you're handling the thing, holding it in your hand. So how do you paint what your hands are feeling?" That's what he said he was trying to do, at least.
But I would love to talk to Ion about specific people, like you do with the Pluin, you know, and say...
Well, you can. You can ask Ion that.
That's true. Were they dumbing down their perspective, you know, and just spouting off some verbiage so that they satisfied whoever was interviewing them, but actually what they saw was different? It was more expanded.
McLuhan has a whole book on that. I really like it.
Yeah, it's called Through the Vanishing Point.
The Vanishing Point, and he has very beautiful examples of how perspective change and the point of view is reflected also in literature and poetry and art, yeah, like how men describe their visual space. It's very nice.
Hey, can you see that, Roxy? That people would be, you know, relating their experience in a different way, or what would seem like a normal way, when actually they had like a dolly version of what they were seeing, but they would never say it because it would be not appropriate for.
No, they did say it. See, are you trying to? You're wondering if they used occult methods.
Well, not so subversive, but yeah, more methods that were not exposing who they really were underneath. So I guess that.
Well, back then, they were like craftsmen. They kept their secrets to themselves. You know, they were professionals. Their livelihood meant that they had some tricks that others didn't have, so that people would still like their creativity. So
yeah.
That's a given that they're not telling everybody anything. They're not telling everybody all of it.
Like
it's a different world today. Artists and writers and that have to pretend they're telling you because they're interviewed so much, and they have to sort of maybe keep it secret and not tell you in a new way. So they got to come up with something that covers up what their tricks are.
Yeah, how does that work now? How do they cover it up with the media the way we have it now? You know, it's well,
they become very bland. You know, if you're an author, you've got to go on book tours, and you have to sign books with people who are conventionally celebrating you and putting on a pedestal, whatever, not really learning your point. They just want to consume and be impressed. So you have to meet that kind of normal middle-class situation constantly. You know, the artists in history, they only hung out with themselves. I mean, with their equals. You know, they didn't. Mm-hmm. If they did mingle in the community, nobody knew what they did. They were not forced to interact with the public.
Maybe here you can add what you told me, your insight on the 22 about Thomas Pynchon and his books. Because
what's the 22? What's the 22?
You discovered this.
But the pattern of
insights two days ago, yeah.
Well, I discovered that.
Yes, I think artists somehow, maybe without really being aware, start expressing these new changes in the environment and the
they have talents. Like Pynchon's a naturally interesting writer, but he read McLuhan, and that influenced him. There's one book on that. They have a couple of letters and stuff that he wrote in Les Sissies to some students about his interest in McLuhan, how he applied it. But I realized lately that I knew it before, but I'm reading his latest book, which leads up to 9-1-1, and it's much the same as the other books, but he's describing the last decade, say. And then I realized all of his books cover 250 years, like my chart, the big chart, 1750 to 2020. He's covering all that from a McLuhanist perspective, and maybe a few others, but pretty uniquely McLuhan, by concentrating on examples in the characters that are effects of the environment. So his books are not in this order, but you can put the books into an order where Mason and Dixon is about the printing press era and Ben Franklin era. Then Against the Day is about the 19th century. And then Gravity's Rainbow is about the 20s, 30s, 40s. Then V is about the 50s. And The Crying of Lot 49 is about the mid-60s with color TV coming in. I map it up with each technological phase. Then, and that book, Crying of Lot 69, was written in 66. And it's about the mid-60s and the LSD period. And then it takes another 40 years to come to 2009 when he does Inherent Vice, which is about the later 60s after what The Crying of Lot 49 does. And then you have a book called Vineland, came out in 1990, which is about the 60s and the 80s. So, but it does come into the 80s. And then you have this new book, which deals with the 90s and the Bush era. So they're written out of order, but they are a history of media and the effects on American life and European life for 250 years. It's pretty amazing novelization of what McLuhan writes about. So that's what you wanted me to point out, right, Roxy?
Yes, and because McLuhan is talking here about a nonlinear reality that he somehow is trying to put some order in the environment he's living. And
he's putting order into it when he uses a book. A book is meant to create visual order. So when he writes about the environment, he's trying to put it in visual order. But he had to invent the content, the writing style had to be up to date. Couldn't be a traditional form of a dictionary. But he is using the visual medium for the purpose of putting things in perspective for your left hemisphere. But he worked in other media, which would require other tasks.
Yes, and also, for example, the books of McLuhan, they can be read all as the same book, like a whole
right.
book on the same topic, like you call that the conceptual continuity.
Yeah.
Like it's creating one huge work in many different parts or many different works.
Yeah, many different audiences targeted. Conceptual continuity is Zappa's term. McLuhan's more perceptual continuity. But Zappa's conceptual continuity does get guided by the acoustic perception and maybe even an audio tactile perception, as McLuhan's is too.
Can I ask you a question? I was kind of wondering about your role in this, and you know, you always cite other authors, McLuhan and Zappa, and people, you know, as far as how they phrase things or how they put things out there in the world, and I was wondering about how you're doing it. What do you say about yourself?
Well, Roxy named it earlier. James Joyce, Zappa, Wyndham Lewis, they did what McLuhan called program the whole environment. They would take the whole world as their content. That's why their works are so encyclopedic. Pynchon's work is very encyclopedic. So what I did, I'm in a later stage where I'm able to witness these previous programmers of their whole world and their total absorption of all their worlds, media worlds and that, that I'm standing on the shoulders of those programmers. So I'm processing and making the content of my world all those people that made the whole world their content.
Okay.
Which is pretty close to what Ion does. Ion is the whole world content. He's the completion of what the Egyptians started off and what the 20th century artists, they retrieved the Egyptian idea because they had access to so much, not just their own particular culture. So they realized the artist has to, as McLuhan says, program the whole world and its content to point out how inflated we are. Not negatively, but how huge we are with these new media environments that are extending us. So I try to be the ultimate extension of all the extensions. And that was done so well by me, I actually evoked the real extension of everything. Ion.
Yes, and if we look to the meaning of poetry, which is making.
Yes.
And art and technology. It's like art and technology are poetry, are communication.
And poetry is art and technology and business and media in general.
Yes, and that's why I'm saying lately that we had to go beyond the conceptions we had before about, for example, art, technology, and this and that, because these concepts have to be extended. Like you said, the greatest artists are persons that, for most people, are not artists. They're in other fields. But because
right.
of their influence in the environment, they were really artists because they were really
yes.
shaping.
Yes, like Wyndham Lewis said, hey, Picasso, stop painting a studio and making dumb little canvases to put in museums. Offer yourself up to program the city to be a town planner. Use your talents on broader environments.
Which is
that
why
was, that
whole,
was Wyndham Lewis's
this whole arena, this whole arena that you've created, you know, is so unique. Yet, it's kind of unrelatable to. That's why you know I think Ion talks to a little man. He's just ridiculous trying to say, "Go here and enjoy this," because, as Roxy said, you know, you just. It's not there. You know, they're not going to relate. That's fine.
And, for example, there are things that Bob says that sound totally absurd, like he used to say, I'm a black woman. But those are metaphors. And he's talking about how, for example, the electric environment turned on black population. But if you don't know this, you think Bob is crazy.
Yeah.
But you don't get the metaphor. And that happens with many things he's saying, because people just take it literally. They don't have the knowing to understand the poetry and what he's saying, the metaphors.
Bob's example of tactility. Bob gives
an
example of tactility.
Yeah, I'm a tactile radio artist. I made a tactile radio show in the 80s.
Yeah, I was going to say, what you've already created in the past had so much of this content. You know, it was so outrageous that
yeah.
you already laid the groundwork. But it wasn't really, you know, in preference. I'm not sure that's the right word. It wasn't related to what was coming. It was kind of juxtaposed. You know, you made fun of all this stuff that you did in a fun way. And then Ian showed up, and it was a serious, but not serious, environment.
Many environments. It's not serious, but not serious, is that you're acting differently in different environments. And in some environments, you have to be funny. In other environments, you have to be serious. So it's not that
yeah.
you're a contradictory person. You have to be different ways with different environments, and we have access to more and more environment. That's the fate of the artist in the 20th century.
Okay, say it all. You know, it's to me, the whole Ion thing was everything at once. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's get some reading done here. They are saying, I'll mute everybody.
All participants are now muted.
So the writer may be Eric McLuhan. He was living in New York in 68, editing the McLuhan Dew Line. Eric would have been 26 or so years old. He's born around 1942. But he knows his father's stuff pretty good. So he says, what are the elements that have entered McLuhan's style, then dominated and transformed it? They are these. One, all-at-onceness. Let us start with the structure of the McLuhan phrase or sentence, and then work our way up to the structure of the book as a whole. Basically, the McLuhan sentence may be thought of as an attempt to parallel, with the written word, the total impact of the new electronic media of our day. As you know, radio and television and the computer have certain characteristics in common. These characteristics are diametrically opposed to those of print. Foremost among them, of course, is the instant transmission of information, or all-at-onceness. Television and radio are instant everywhere. The computer, as acknowledged in a recent ad, feeds you an encyclopedia a minute. What took hours and perhaps even days to absorb through a magazine or book is given to you in seconds by a television receiver or a computer. When information thus moves at electronic speeds, things happen to it. Details become blurred and tend to disappear. Cause and effect relationships are drastically compressed, and both the cause and the effect appear simultaneously in the same instant. Thus they become no longer step by step, but instant pattern, and with detail left behind and cause and effect changed into pattern, what emerges in bold outline is simply and severely structure, and structure is in big capital letters. Then in brackets, this is the reason, incidentally, why computers now present much of their output in the form of charts or diagrams. The details are too numerous to be important. They are therefore not even presented, and in their place, representing hundreds of thousands of these details, is simple structure. End of bracket. Close bracket. McLuhan uses the same process as the basis for his style. He condenses, he compresses, he aphorizes. That means makes aphorisms. He throws everything at you at once. He changes writing from a single-level process to a multi-level process, from one idea at a time, in brackets, step by step, to many ideas at the same time, all captured and reverberating in the same 10 or 15 words. By doing this, by using such severe compression, McLuhan creates in his writing a series of aphorisms, or to use a far better, though more unfamiliar word, icons. The iconic concept is perhaps the key to McLuhan's structure. It is an attempt to produce pattern in writing through absolute essentiality. It is an attempt to create instant truth. It is dangerous, but when it works supremely well. For example, and they give a couple of these short aphoristic statements, the Volkswagen is wraparound space, unquote. Literacy via printing produces hardware. Gutenberg was the father of all the semilines, unquote. And then they say, and the great classic, to which we will return later, the medium is the message, unquote. This, then, is the first step to understanding McLuhan's style, to realize his use of all-at-once-ness or compression, speed-up of information flow. It is also a reason why most critics who try to explain McLuhan make pages out of his sentences. All right. The next characteristic element is earness, E-A-R hyphen N-E-S-S. The other characteristics can be presented far more briefly. Paramount among them is McLuhan's insistence on writing for the ear rather than the eye. The new electronic media, of course, involved many of our senses rather than just one, as did print. Radio, records, tapes, and public address systems may have seemed completely ear-oriented at first, but teenagers soon discovered that they could be made marvelously tactile when the sound was turned up high enough so that it assaulted the skin as well. That's the bone conduction we were talking about earlier. Television, as Dr. McLuhan has said over and over again, is primarily tactile, as well as visual, as well as oral. And computers are now learning how to talk. Remember HAL in 2001, which that movie came out right at the time this was being written, and are now being fitted. Computers are now learning how to talk and are now being fitted with arms, legs, and entire factories to complete their tasks. And why not the printed word? In the 20th century alone, Yeats did it. Joyce did it, as we shall soon discover in depth, and McLuhan does it. His lines are meant to be heard as well as seen. They gain levels, permutations, sensuosities as soon as they are spoken as well as read. And above all, they gain new meaning, a meaning that could not be achieved by print alone, that depends as often on oral pun as on surprise and interface. For example, to run through just four of the permutations of his classic phrase, the medium is the message, the medium is the massage, the medium is the mass age, the medium is the mess age. Mass age is hyphenated, and the fourth line, mess age, is hyphenated. Try reading these four lines out loud. They make a beautiful little poem. So that was element number two, earness. Now element number three is discontinuity. Now we come to that part of Dr. McLuhan's style that has caused the most readers the most difficulty. This is his choice of discontinuity as the organizing principle of his work, rather than the conventional continuity or step-by-step flow. Let us compare the two, continuity and discontinuity, for to understand them is not only to understand McLuhan, but also such other seemingly unrelated modern entities as Salvador Dali, the Electric Circus, which is the Andy Warhol Club in the village, and Ling Temco Vought. I guess that's a company, though I'm not sure. L-I-N-T-E-M-P-C-O hyphen V-O-U-G-H-T. Hyphen between Ling and Temco and one between Temco and Vought. Most writing we are accustomed to in both fiction and nonfiction is organized according to the principle of continuity. This means that such writing is linear. And remember, they're not saying this, but we're listening to a linear presentation of McLuhan here. This means that such writing is linear. It proceeds in a straight line, one thought after another, like a line of railroad cars. It is progressive. One thought comes out of another in an expected pattern and builds on it, leading to the next thought. And it is filled with verbal road signs. You were told what to expect within the sentence by such verbal connectives as and, but, because, etc. And you were told what to expect in the book as a whole by such structural aids as the table of contents, chapter headings, etc. Discontinuity, on the other hand, purposely and deliberately violates all these rules. It eliminates the verbal road signs and lets thoughts crash into each other head-on. It proceeds from thought to thought, subject to subject, not by logical progression, but by free association. Thus, instead of developing in a predictable straight line, it constantly turns unexpected corners and leaves the unprepared reader far behind. A perfect example of this, quote, development by discontinuity, unquote, is the beginning of War and Peace in the Global Village. And it is at this point that this essay leaves off explanation and begins its sensory retraining functions. Pick up the book now and read the first few pages, let's say page 7 to the bottom of page 16, just as you ordinarily would. When you finish them, turn back to this paragraph. The chances are, if you expected the usual straight-line logical development, that you encounter several disturbing elements even in these first few pages. Let us leave aside the marginal quotes, which we will deal with in the next section. With such a perceptual set, that's in quotes, with such a perceptual set dominating your reading, many of these first paragraphs must have seemed irrelevant and others confusing. Now let us change our perceptual set and approach the same material through an expectation filter of discontinuity, associational development, and a mosaic or walk-around overall pattern. The overall theme of these first pages is the pain or discomfort caused by the replacement of one technological environment by another. The first paragraph on page 7 describes the old print-determined environment. The second describes the new electronic environment and the change it inevitably causes in our sensory modes. The third paragraph introduces the main theme, quote, that new environments inflict considerable pain on the observer, unquote. The fourth paragraph presents, without the use of the customary transitional phrases, three flash examples of this environmental shift pain at three different points in man's history. The first in the time of Hieronymus Bosch, maybe around the time of Shakespeare, then radio's impact in the 20s, then that caused by TV today. The excerpt from a Bosch painting presented on pages 8 and 9 shows instantly, quote, the confusion of spaces resulting from the Gutenberg technology invasion of the old tactile world of medieval iconography, unquote, as described on page 7. On page 10, paragraph 2 now moves into a comparison. Between this shift in sensory mode caused by new environments and a similar shift caused by a blind person suddenly being able to see. Do that again. On page 10, paragraph 2 now moves into a comparison between this shift in sensory mode caused by new environments and a similar shift caused by a blind person suddenly being able to see. In the bottom paragraph on page 11, McLuhan equates the sensory overload and resultant pain caused by this sudden acquisition of sight by the blind with our global problem in encountering the new electronic technology. So the acquiring of sight is as shocking for the blind as dealing with the global theater is. In both cases, the immediate reaction is to long for the old, simpler, and less painful environment. This leads immediately to the discussion of the artist and his unique reaction to new environments in the first paragraph on page 12. This acceptance of new environments by the artist is then immediately contrasted in paragraph 2 on page 12 with the average person's rejection of these same environments. The reason for this rejection follows in the quote from, quote, theories of personality, unquote. Now, on page 13 come two complete breaks with conventional continuity. The conventional reader, therefore, smashes into them as though they were brick walls. Paragraph 2 on page 13 once again refers back to the modern visual world and its present replacement by a postmodern electronic environment. Using the word postmodern, that wasn't really known back then. But they're saying post-modern. Nowadays, it's postmodern with a hyphen. I mean, with no hyphen. Let me just check, see if everything's okay. All right. In a linear organization, it would have been placed. In a linear organization, it would have been placed behind paragraph 1 on page 7. So he's saying that paragraph 2 on page 13 once again refers back to the modern visual world and its present replacement by a postmodern electronic environment. In a linear organization, it would have been placed behind paragraph 1 on page 7, but it's on page 13. Paragraph, okay, in brackets, try it now in this linear position and see how much comfortable it is. Why McLuhan does not place it on page 7 there will be explained in the next section. Paragraph 3, and that's end of that bracket, the bracket at that point. Paragraph 3 on page 13 once again refers to art and the impact caused by and the impact caused upon it by new environments. Logically, in quotes, logically, it would have been placed after paragraph 1 on page 12. In the middle of this paragraph, however, and once again without the conventional verbal road signs, McLuhan blends from art to pain, and once again through the middle of page 16 develops more deeply the meaning of this pain through a comparison between it and the referred pain caused by surgery. Thus we have the opening pages of War and Peace in the Global Village, giving us all the stylistic characteristics that determine the rest of the book. Discontinuity rather than continuity, alogic rather than logic, association rather than progression, surprise rather than preparation, sometimes even a complete break with our own expectations and the placement of thoughts or paragraphs where we would at first almost swear they don't belong. The big question is why? What does this style gain from this apparent disorder? Let us now see. So you come to element number 4, discovery. Discovery. You have now read the first few pages of War and Peace twice. Now let's go over them a third time and see what effects this style gives us that logic and continuity would not. What emerges quite clearly throughout all these pages is a sentence inversion that forces us to encounter new thoughts before we are thoroughly prepared for them. A good example of this, quote, unprepared transition or interface occurs between paragraphs 3 and 4 on page 7. Paragraph 3 talks of the pain inflicted by a new environment on the observer. Paragraph 4 gives three examples through the ages of artistic responses to this pain. But we do not realize this when we first move from paragraph 3 to paragraph 4. Why? Because McLuhan places the transitional sentence in the middle of paragraph 4 rather than at its beginning. The paragraph would have been easier for you had it read something like this. Quote, "The horror pictures of Hieronymus Bosch are a faithful artistic report of the pain and misery that result from a new technology. When print was new in the 16th century, he painted the new confusion of spaces," unquote. Easier? Yes, but also somehow far thinner. Dr. McLuhan has evidently decided to sacrifice such easily achieved clarity for several other, and in his opinion, that of the other great 20th century writers and artists, for more valuable effects. These include the ability to keep the reader in a state of constant awareness, since he can never take the meaning of the next thought for granted. The sudden disclosure of previously undetected similarities and relationships by eliminating transitions and forcing thoughts into abrupt interface with each other, just as modern abstract painting has eliminated perspective or middle distance, and surrealist painters such as Dalí force seemingly unrelated images to share the same dreamlike space. Involvement of the reader in the thought process as well as the content of each page. The transformation of language from a series of prepared messages to heuristic probes into new experiences. And above all, the ability to present multi-perspective montages of new phenomena so they are seen, not from one rigid point of view, but from many points of view simultaneously. Again, to refer back to Cubist painting, from all around at once. This is what is done with the central theme of these first pages, and this is what is done with the other themes that follow it throughout the book. Perhaps the easiest way to appreciate this style in this book is to unravel it for a moment, to reduce the multi-sensuous world of McLuhan to a single plane of continuous narrative, to reconstruct the book on a simple linear basis for you, and then let you compare the original and the simplified and judge for yourself. Let us do this now. So it goes into section 3, but we'll take a break here and see if there's any comments.
All participants are now unmuted.
This is what you said before. The book is trying to create order. And today is the topic, the structure and the content. And the form.
Yes, I'm on mute, having a drink.
It's interesting, the reference of the sensory training function that you discussed in the last part of the four elements, and how the illogical layout of how they were presenting the thoughts just to train the person to look at McLuhan's style.
Yeah, tolerate a little discontinuity.
Yes, yes. And that's showing that he's using that as a tool, using this the dew line as a tool, but also referencing seeing the War and Peace in the Global Village. So it's really a comprehensive tool that they're presenting in this number 3 dew line.
Yep.
It's interesting, very interesting.
He's a meta book. He's telling you about what the book does to you and showing you what the book you're not used to does. And then he puts out a newsletter linearly explaining the nonlinear book. So he's getting you used to different media and their laws and their features. Rather than just reading up, take your mother, who reads a lot of books. A lot of novels, a lot of romances, whatever they read. They're never reminded of the act of reading itself at a beginning point. Then they're never reminded that the new environment contradicts all the values that the act of reading inculcated.
Yes.
So this is a program of cosmic awareness, not limited to concepts. He's trying to do perceptual, environmental programming, so they become aware of what you're being conditioned by in your environment. It's quite a task.
Yes. It's a lot of work done in this. There was a lot of work put in to present this.
It's like, you know, a Sistine Chapel. When you look at all the books and all the work he did and all the education or learning that went into it, the history, the knowledge, it's a major, you know, Gothic cathedral, actually, that they've made.
Vincent,
you know, the environment.
What we saw lately is how all this big data on the Ubervegence, people have this paranoia of something controlling them without their really knowing who this power is. I think people are somehow aware of this effect of the environment, but they tend to make this anthropomorphic interpretation. There must be a big brother.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's got to be a super brain. They don't even know that the world's run by committee. It's like Dave Emmer used to joke that Americans thought that World War II was caused by one guy. It was the lone nut theory of history. This one guy went on a rampage named Adolf Hitler and fooled the whole world into a global conflict leading to an atomic bomb. The lone nut view of history.
Yes, or the First World War was supposed to be started because they killed this.
Yeah, this is what the little stupid creep print. Oh, just a side thing. In Thomas Pynchon's book Against the Day, which is about Chicago, it begins in Chicago in the 1890s, there's a great section on that guy who gets assassinated, Prince Ferdinand of Austria, whoever he was. He comes and he's a total asshole, and he's being an ignorant rich kid in Chicago. And so it's this great section where this guy, you're reading about what a jerk he was, and you know he's going to get fucking assassinated in 1914 and cause World War One.
Yes, and that's another thing you said. Big Brother was already
happening.
When did you say it was?
Well, Orwell's book, 1984, written in 1948, you know, reverse the number, is about the year, about 1900, McLuhan said in the 50s. He sort of said it was 1934 in Take Today in 1972, but basically it's way back, well before how it's presented as 1984. And you take the 1984 is about the division of the world into three or four sections, you know, Oceania and this other part, like there's Asia, Europe, and America, and there might be another one. And people in 1900 were living on farms, and it was agricultural society in the United States. They weren't thinking of what the telegraph was doing. They didn't know that the elites in Europe and in New York City could get around the world pretty fast with their airplanes and stuff. So it was a global village for them, at least by 1900, and they had to start. The oil companies got together way back then and coordinated their regions. They just were bumping into each other too much, so they started to program the marketing of these big resources. But the little person in a little town reading a newspaper, if they even could read, could not see the global village. And so what Orwell's describing happening in 84 was actually happening in 1900. Now, 1984 is after a nuclear war. So you could say, well, there was no nuclear war in 1900. Well, McLuhan used to say that radio and TV were more devastating than the bomb for how they change people, where the sun don't shine, you know?
And I think this is a great example of how we look back in the rear mirror and see the bonanza and don't see what's going on now, which is what
people
you
here,
are trying to make
right
people
here,
aware of.
People hear us and with ION, and they'll put JW/ION. They might think it's just JW, but if they think it's more than JW, they think it's channeling. We are not a channeled situation here with ION, as we saw when ION became the hologram. We are an invisible environment, and where everybody projects his rearview mirror on us.
Mm.
That's why there's a lot of people who should be in the alternative culture, should be here, but they live one stage back. they live in the counterculture or whatever Shirley MacLaine realities that they've imbibed and thought they were learning from. And the Evereeds were the best of that kind of stuff, channel information. But Ion is way beyond that. And they can't see it. So we are a technological environment because people can't see what we are.
Yes, they're projecting interpretations that are very, very, very wrong. Like you are a cult or you are...
I'm a rip-off artist. I got JW arrested so I could rip him off.
Yes,
that's
well,
been said.
I just want to say I have to
love
10 more minutes, but, so just in case
okay,
I have to
you'll
go.
Only say another... Well, it goes to 10 o'clock. You can't go till 10:30?
No.
Okay, well, at least... I know, I haven't got that much left. You might be able to hear about half of it. So... We are glad that
you're
here for this part.
Love how you can, Bob, don't you love how you can say that about JW and now we just laugh? We're like, yeah, right.
Yeah.
Nothing
yes.
True.
Well, okay, that's another topic. So we're going to go into section three, which is, you know, about four or five pages. So there's only three sections. So we've done two sections, the introduction, and then the elements, the four elements we did. So now we're going to, they're going to reconstruct the book on a simple linear basis for you and then let you compare the original and the simplified and judge for yourself. All right, here we go. Section three opens with a quote from Jill Johnson. She was a writer for the Village Voice. She reviewed a lot of the avant-garde art worlds in the 60s, I used to read her, Jill Johnson. And it says, Jill Johnson writing not about McLuhan, but about Mercy Cunningham, who was John Cage's partner and a dance guru, who also bases his work on discontinuity. So she's writing about Mercy Cunningham. So this is like an update of comparing McLuhan to Picasso. This is McLuhan compared, I guess, to Mercy Cunningham. Quote, says Jill Johnson, this seemed important as a guide to understanding what might have been difficult for some to appreciate and enjoy while unsettled in their expectations. When a thing looks so different, people say, well, where did that come from? And so on. And ask for levers to understand it. So they're saying this section, part three, is going to give levers on understanding McLuhan's what people don't expect. So I'm rereading that. This seemed important as a guide to understanding what might have been difficult for some to appreciate and enjoy while unsettled in their expectations. When a thing looks so different, people say, well, where did that come from? And so on. And ask for levers to understand it. When McLuhan was interviewed by Richard Castellanos in January 67 for the New York Times, he's talking about percepts and he doesn't deal in concepts, but he does admit that you need to give people concepts so they can get a grip on reality. So because you present a book, which naturally is interpreted as ideas and concepts, that's the effect of the book. So he wrote books to give people concepts to get a grip on the reality, but the task of perceiving the present required a lot more than what you got from one of his books. Okay, so it starts off saying, let us first deal with the marginal quotes and use them. Now, these are the marginal quotes from Finnegan's Wake, which, you know, in 1968, nobody knew how to read. So it's pretty advanced putting even Finnegan's Wake in your book. So they go, let us first deal with the marginal quotes and use them as a perfect example of the earnest that runs through all of modern writing and art. All of these marginal quotes are from James Joyce's Finnegan's Wake, a modern masterpiece usually considered completely unintelligible by eye-dominated people. McLuhan believes that Joyce understood more about media and their effect on society than any other man in history. Finnegan's Wake may be thought of as a guide to media, but one presented in an entirely different language than that encountered in other books of its time. This is language written for the ear as well as the eye. Therefore, the only way to read it is so that it can be heard, preferably without being read at the same time. In brackets, if you try to read it with the eye alone, it will be nothing but a jumble to you. End of bracket. The perfect way to do this is with a tape recorder. Open the book to any page you wish, pick out one of the quotes and record it. Then play it back again with the book closed. Listen to it over again two or three times and watch the meanings emerge. Joyce, as well as McLuhan, reveals meaning upon meaning by the use of oral puns. Words that sound alike are equated to reveal unexpected truths. Let's take an example from page 22 and see how far a few joicing words can go. Oh, I forgot to mute you guys, but that's good. We get your reaction to that. They pick page 22. What do you think of that? Okay, mute everybody.
All participants are now muted.
Okay. Let us take an example from page 22 and see how far a few joicing words can go. Here's the quote. He's heard of hoarding, and her face is altered. I'll spell it. H-E-R-D, of hoarding, H-O-A-R-D-I-N-G, and her face, F-A-I-T-H-S, is altered, A-L-T-A-R-E-D. He's heard of hoarding, and her face is altered. So, analogies spring up almost at once. Heard equals hard equals hear equals heard, H-E-A-R-D. They all sound alike. Hoarding equals whoring equals hearing. He's hard of hearing. He's heard of hoarding. He's hard of whoring. He's heard, H-E-R-D, a group of animals or men, of hoarding, to group or collect. Thus, herds herd. He's hard of hearing equals he's heard of hoarding. The hard of hearing hoard because their access to information is cut down, and so on. So you would have to see this to get all this as I'm doing this, but let's move along. The bottom phrase yields as much resonance and sheer fun. Faith equals face equals phase. Alter equals alter, A-L-T-E-R, equals altar equals alter or alter. Her face is altered. Her face is altered. Her face is altered. Her phase is altered. Her face, F-A-I-T-H-S, is altered. Her face is altered, covered with tears, etc. Now combine the two phrases and you are suddenly exploring several simultaneous resonating levels of existence. He's hard of whoring and her face is altered. He's hard of hearing and her phase is altered. Cut down information access and you alter patterns of response. He's heard of hoarding and her face is altered, and so on. Now, is all this merely a put on? Many readers will ask at this point, can this much information be packed into these few words? Did Joyce intend these meanings? Could he possibly have foreseen even a fraction of them? Or are you simply reading them into his words to make a point? The answers are no, we are not just making a point. Joyce did intend simultaneous, some humorous, some dead serious meanings like these. Most he anticipated. Others he realized would come from the interface of the individual reader and the clues he gave that reader in his words. And these multi-meanings were made possible by the rediscovery by Joyce and Yeats, Eliot, the symbolists, McLuhan, and others of the sensory and ideational richness of the ear in comparison to the thin simplicity of straight-line visual thinking. It will richly reward you, then, to take one of these margin quotes each night and play with it on your tape recorder. If you don't have a tape recorder, simply say it out loud several times. As we will show below, you will then hear much more in McLuhan, in Jackson Pollock, in pop music, and even in certain annual business reports. Now, having once again explored the richness of multi-level meanings in these margin quotes, let us leave them behind and for the moment reduce the main text of War and Peace to a straight linear argument. Here we go. Let's pick up the book now and read it a second way. The main subject of War and Peace in the Global Village is this, that a shift in technologies and the environments they produce causes a shift in human institutions and therefore in the people who comprise them. We are undergoing such a shift at this moment from a visual to an electronic organization of our lives. Such a shift is bound to be painful. This is the theme of the first 16 pages, which you have already explored. This pain component of technological shift is also explored more deeply at further intervals throughout the book. Let us gather them together in a straight line now and read them one after the other as though there were no other material in between. The first 16 pages describes this pain, tells us it derives from technological shift, gives examples of artistic reaction to it throughout the ages, illustrates it with comparisons to physiological pain within the body itself. Now turn to page 54. Here, disregarding the first two sentences for the moment, McLuhan shows why this pain is so intense that it causes spastic disorganization of society for centuries after the prime technological shift takes place. To pick this up, read 54, 55, and the first two paragraphs of page 56. Now turn to page 60. Start with the bottom paragraph on this page and read to the interplanetary message on page 65. Interplanetary message is in italics. Here, McLuhan begins to detail the spastic condition of our society at this time, reeling under the impact of the shift to electronic technology. Now skip to the bottom paragraph on page 70. From here to page 102, consequences of this technological pain and the attempts to dull it, outlined in a dozen different manifestations for you. In brackets, read this section quickly at your top reading speed. As always with McLuhan, don't worry if you don't immediately get the full meaning of a stray sentence or two. The meaning will emerge in the context of the section as you get deeper into it. He examines each thought from several different angles. One reinforces another. Therefore, the more material you cover, the more deeply each individual meaning emerges, even if it was obscure at first. Now skip to page 116. Here, from the second paragraph on page 116 to the first paragraph on 118, is a brief and beautiful glimpse of the Oriental solution to this problem, : exaggerated courtesy. That's their solution. Now skip to page 126 and see another universal solution, that of the rearview mirror. And the next four paragraphs, till the middle of 127, finish McLuhan's discussion of technological pain and its effects on society. You have now pulled the individual units of this discussion out of the book and read them one after the other, as though McLuhan had himself gathered them together in a single conventional chapter, entitled it, quote, "The Pain Associated with Shifts in Technologies and Its Effects Upon Society," unquote. This is linear organization. We are artificially reading it into this book in order to, one, make the book more immediately accessible to linear patterns of information gathering. Two, to then go on and break down these linear patterns and allow you to feel at home with more modern material that uses nonlinear patterns. Now, we can do the same thing, organized on linear lines, the other main themes in this book. Here they are more briefly. First theme, the effect of technology shift on war, starts on page 25 with a prologue concerning the visual organization of Greek and Roman society, out of which their war machine came. On page 26 goes into the invention of the stirrup and the revolution in war technique, and thus in society it caused. This continues to 34, then skips to 37 with Oliver Cromwell's reorganization of war on the Gutenberg principle of lineality. This continues to page 44, then skips to 102, and to Napoleon as both tribal leader and the child of the new industrial age. This runs into 111 to 116, modern technology and war. Then to 118 to 127, war today as education and society shaper. And finally, 132 to 135, the first electronic wars. Now, the second theme, how to make the fish see the water. Touched on, as you know, in the first 16 pages, in the discussion of the artist as creator of counter-environments, in brackets, devices by which the primary or enveloping environment is made visible, end of bracket, continued on 17 to 20, and then summarized in relation to all the other themes on 175 to the end. However, this discussion of art and anti-environments on page 20 leads directly into the third theme, the Boer War, spelled B-O-R-E, pun on that war at the end of the 19th century in South Africa. The Boer War, Fashion as Weaponry and Anti-Environment, starts on page 20 to 24, continues on 157 to 168. In brackets, notice how fashion interpenetrates here with war, the impact each has on the other. This is a typical example of how McLuhan relates superficially unrelated phenomena and why he adopted the mosaic style as the only coherent verbal means to portray this constant interrelation and interpenetration of our time. Close bracket. Next theme, or is this the fourth theme, the environment as clothing. Starting on page 34, how we wear not only fashions but computers. Goes to 36, then jumps to 65 and 66. In brackets, the discussion of Pavlov's experiments, not as pertaining to conditioned reflexes but to controlled environments. Controlled environments is hyphenated. Brief but extremely fertile. Now notice he's talking about wearing computers. Well, that's where we've gotten to today. You know, the stuff's getting pretty tiny. They're embedding computers into the fabric. But we're already wearing them, even though they were huge, you know, 50 years ago. The next theme, theme 5, the effect of the new environment on youngsters. That's all in one section, page 133 to 147. The sixth theme, the new environment and the new education, scattered in paragraphs throughout the entire book, but brought together most densely in pages 149 to 155. Then the seventh theme, games and the new technology, on pages 168 to 173. Also, a lovely capsule history of the old visual environment is already mentioned in another context, that of war. That's on pages 24 to 26. Edmund Burke, he's a guy in the 1700s, sort of the father of conservatism. Edmund Burke, he was a conservative reaction to the French Revolution. Edmund Burke as both rearview mirror and prognosticator is on page 44 to 53. And, of course, many marvelous insights, unclassifiable really, scattered throughout the entire book. There you have it, a linear way to read War and Peace in the Global Village. When you have finished it, you will have a logical, orderly skeleton on McLuhan's thoughts in this book. You will not have the richness, the interpenetration, the all-at-onceness, the mosaic multiplicity that gives you a field, overall grasp of the problems discussed, rather than merely a train trip around their edges. So the prose linear level was a train trip around their edges. So note that. McLuhan's creating a field, an ionic field. So then they say, therefore, once you have finished this linear reading, we ask you to go over the book once again. But this time, do it this way. Give yourself an uninterrupted hour. With the skeleton outline of the content in your mind, read the entire book at one setting. At one setting, as fast as you can. In brackets, it may help speed you up to use your index as a pacer, running it under each line as fast as your eyes can follow it. Now, Eric was studying speed reading. He and his father were studying speed reading at this time, so they're putting a little plug in for speed reading. Then it's written, if you don't thoroughly understand a line, go on anyway. Let the context define it for you later. Go from beginning to end in about an hour. What should emerge is this. Your mind should be able to hold all of the main themes, or most of them, in suspension at once. In other words, you should be able now to deal with the subject on a multi-level basis. You will see that none of these ideas is separate, just as none of these societies is separate, just as none of these technologies is separate, just as none of these historic eras is separate. They all interpenetrate each other. In brackets, separation and classification and linear organization are all artificial ways of dealing with reality. They worked as long as reality was simple. When it got complex, they began to fail. The multi-level style, the style we have tried to immerse you in here, is an attempt to deal with this new reality in all its complexity. That is why we think it has been worth your while to try these few exercises here in order to become more comfortable with such a style. And I assume the bracket happens there. We don't have a bracket finishing this section. Anyways, on page 21, now let us briefly look at some other applications of this mode of perception outside of the writings of Dr. McLuhan. All right, so I will take a break here.
All participants are now unmuted.
Wow. That was pretty comprehensive what you just read, Bob, of their approach, how they're outlining the approach. It's really comprehensive. Speed reading, that's interesting.
Right, and there's only one more page, which is made up of two little pages. There's 23 little pages, so we only have to do 22 and 23 for part four. And let's see. So they're saying McLuhan consciously did the William Burroughs method and cut up the prose, scattered the themes, made them be in one part of the book and then not show up for another 100 pages, or to be short here and then long later, right? So he purposely chopped it up. So a naive reader back then would accuse McLuhan of being just disorganized. But if actually stepped aside and read this corrected outline, it was all pretty straightforward if you knew what to put together.
Yeah.
It's a pretty simple book if you made it linear. Any other comments? Okay, so mute everybody.
All participants are now muted.
In this section four, part four, we're going to look briefly at some other applications of this new mode of perception outside of the writings of Dr. McLuhan. So they begin with a quote from the rock band, the Jefferson Airplane. in their album called Today. And the quote says, "To go on from here, I can't use words. They don't say enough." So I assume that's the album Today or a song called Today. "To go on from here, I can't use words. They don't say enough." That's like the quote from T.S. Eliot, you know, 40 years earlier, "I've got to use words when I talk to you," from his incomplete creation called Sweeney Agonistes. So McLuhan says here, "We have already touched on the use of discontinuity, lack of middle distance," that means like perspective, "oral and tactile rather than visual sensuosity, and the juxtaposition or parataxis of seemingly unrelated images in modern painting." Now go back and look at the way de Kooning tears his Women to pieces. Women is a series of paintings he did, late 40s, early 50s, I think. And Ted Carpenter, McLuhan's associate in making this Duline, will eventually live next door to de Kooning in East Hampton, out there in Further Lane, which Thomas Pynchon satirizes in the book I'm presently reading, The Bleeding Edge, Further Lane. So, and you'll see in the Metro paintings of de Kooning's in the Metropolitan Museum of Art or maybe in Museum of Modern Art that are owned by Ted Carpenter's wife, who was the heiress of the Demenil family, which owned Schlumberger, the French, and I think, oil parts business. And just for interest sake, and so Ted Carpenter's brother-in-law, no, father-in-law, Cecil B., no, what was his name? Cecil Demenil, not sure. He is accused of being involved in the Kennedy assassination because he was based down there in the Dallas elite, Dallas and Houston. So that's a side thing for the record if you want to look it up. Okay, so McLuhan says, "Now go back and look at the way de Kooning tears his Women paintings to pieces. How Arp or Clay or Miró, Juan Miró, create dream worlds which are far more real than photographs," and so on. So they're citing this new discontinuity in painting. Then they write, "Read again James Joyce or T.S. Eliot or Yeats or Baudelaire or Rambo. See again the movies of Fellini or Antonioni or Bergman." I think they got it spelled wrong. Antonioni. I think it's Antonioni. Or Bergman. "Watch television commercials for technique rather than content for one evening. This time, look for interface, sudden transition, all-at-onceness, multi-sensory assaults on your emotions, dream images, or non-rational images, non-linear storytelling, and all the rest." You're to do that in television commercials. Or to watch for that. "Now listen to your kids' music for a while, not only on what they say, which is important and beautiful, but also how they say it. For instance, this passage from Simon Garfunkel, the song called Blessed. Quote, 'Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit. Blessed is the lamb whose blood flows. Blessed are the sat upon, spat upon, ratted upon. O Lord, why have you forsaken me?' End quote. Notice the moving effects Simon or Garfunkel get by discontinuity. In brackets, you have to fill in the remainder of the first two lines. And by the abrupt interface of one culture with another, one emotion, religion, with another, spat upon, ratted upon, one age, early Christianity, with another, ours. Involvement, poignancy, irony, all are heightened." I should say in this song, it says, "Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit, dot, dot, dot. Blessed is the lamb whose blood flows, dot, dot, dot. Blessed are the sat upon, spat upon, ratted upon, dot, dot, dot. O Lord, why have you forsaken me?" So I don't know. Does the song have incomplete sentences? I've never heard it. So I think that's what they're getting at. It doesn't complete with normal literary sentencing or syntax. So this creates involvement, poignancy, and irony. All are heightened. Now listen to the rest of this song and record. It's called Sound of Silence. And then others. See now for yourself that the kids are talking a different language than yours. If you want to sell them or teach them or reach them or live with them, you have to learn the language. They won't come back to yours. And now finally, look at the industrial world around you and ask yourself what the great development, the great trend of the 60s has been here. If the style of discontinuity we have been exploring is valid at all, then it must correspond exactly with developments in the physical and technological world outside itself. Is there then a technology of discontinuity, an embodiment of discontinuity in the industrial world? The answer, quite obviously, is yes. The corporate conglomerate, growth through discontinuity. Unrelated firms under the same corporate umbrella somehow synergizing into even greater profits and growth than the old line related acquisition empires. I read that again. The corporate conglomerate, growth through discontinuity. Unrelated firms under the same corporate umbrella somehow synergizing into even greater profits and growth than the old line related acquisition empires. I guess you would acquire companies that were similar to the one you made your money in. What does it mean for the future? How long can it keep going? What are the rules of management that make discontinuity work, that turn discontinuity into synergy? These are questions for Dr. McLuhan, questions he will deal with in future issues of the McLuhan Do Line. All we have intended to do here today is give you some insight into the style in which he will coach his answers and its structural correspondence to the emerging world of reality which surrounds it. We hope we have accomplished this to some degree. We apologize for taking so much of your time, but it's not as easy to change perceptions as to impart information. We would appreciate your comments. All right, that's the end. 23 pages.
All participants are now unmuted.
Page 22, but they went the pink route and made it 23 pages. So, how's that? That was pretty good, eh?
Yes.
Did I read it too fast?
No.
I have to ask Eliza about that. I think she's been playing before. How was that, Eliza? Too fast? Look at that. She accuses me of sleeping when she's sleeping. Well, she's sleeping right now, and I ain't sleeping, right? I may be nuts, but...
All participants are now unmuted.
Okay, Eliza, and you are. Your phone's here, and you're not even talking. You didn't even know what we did. You're sleeping, Eliza, and I'm not. And the night is young.
Okay,
it's only 10 o'clock.
Okay.
Oh, we woke you up?
Yeah, I heard my name.
Eliza, you can hardly talk. Mumbling your way through to continuity.
That was a long piece you read. I thought, yeah, you said you were going to read two short paragraphs from the last page. I don't know.
What, you fell asleep during it? It was so long?
Yeah, very long.
Okay, I said I'd read two short paragraphs in the last page. Did I say that?
Yeah.
No, you were dreaming. Hallucinating.
No.
Why would I say I'm going to read the last two paragraphs? Right, Bert? Why would I say that?
No.
Can you stop? Bert, you don't remember what he said?
I don't remember two paragraphs. I don't remember that.
Yeah.
He just said we have another section. He said another section, section four.
Yeah.
And
what happened, Eliza heard two, fell asleep, and then heard paragraphs, 5 minutes later, put the two together.
Yeah, that was my way of discontinuity.
Of establishing a rational order in a world gone mad. And you were using a non-rational method, dreaming.
Yep.
All right, she admits it, capitulates. Okay, good.
Bob, have you had contact with Eric McLuhan?
No.
At all?
Eric McLuhan has a problem with me for different reasons.
Oh, okay.
Which I don't think we should go into.
I haven't talked
about it too much. He's got some misconceptions about what me and Nelson had done back in the 90s. They're erroneous, and he was very mad at Nelson, so he lumped me in with it. But that's another issue. So, okay, so we won't let that get you down, Bert.
Okay. No, because the reason why I was asking is because the way, I mean, you said that he presented this, he was probably the primary writer in this, and they were promoting McLuhan's non-linear, illogical presentation. And sorry, I had a disruption for a moment there.
Yeah, the discontinuity.
Yeah, discontinuity in outer environments for a second. That they would be more open now to deal with, not deal with, but to investigate what you're doing now. That's why I asked that.
Eric?
Because, I mean,
Eric would
yeah,
you?
Eric, yes. Eric, yes. I mean, you know, they mentioned interplanetary conditioning, pains associated
yeah.
with technological shifts, you know, helping the fish see the water and all that. And here we are, what, 40 years later? 30-some years
yeah.
later. And 40 years later, and he's nowhere to be found to just try to investigate this. Or maybe he is investigating, but he's not openly engaging you. That's
right.
why I asked.
Well, Eric is a very devout Catholic, and remember, they're presenting this as serious sensory reprogramming, but they are actually old-fashioned POB, print-oriented bastards, confronting what's happening to the children, the baby boomers, and society, and McLuhan is not, he's not out there hanging out in a commune with Tim Leary taking LSD, you know.
Yeah.
They are quite detached, and Eric imitated his father. They are actually, as some people have accused, working for the Vatican and are agents of the Vatican trying to preserve some kind of civilization as the world was going nuts in the late 60s, or appeared to be. I don't know. You guys are told that the 60s were turbulent. To me, the world became even more turbulent. And why say the 60s were a turbulent period? They were an early predictor of the turbulence that was coming. But back then, people really were in the middle of an apocalypse. It was so disrupting. I don't think younger generations can understand the simple media diet and how that was shocking to people. They don't realize how much people have changed. So in that world, a lot of people needed someone to explain what all this chaos seemed to be leading to. And McLuhan served that role for a good stretch of years. And so he was not a radical. He was walking around like a sociological scientist. And what people didn't realize, there was an element of satire in there. So to the degree that McLuhan and Eric are devout Catholic conservatives, they definitely aren't interested in demon possession, which might be what the Pope accuses JW of experiencing. And I've been on there talking about mediums for a long time, even though I know, personally, a good chunk of the McLuhan family went to the Evergreens back in 1976, before I even knew the Evergreens. Mary told me that. So I think Eric is the most conservative of the family, because he has a younger son who's way different from Eric because he was born 10 years later, and then he has all his sisters. So Eric, per se, is apparently, he comes across as pretty staid or old-fashioned, even though I understand he's a very good jazz pianist. I guess that happens when you go home to be social in the United States. In America, you go home to be social and go out to be alone. If you went home where Eric is social, he'll start, let his hair down and play some piano for you. But generally, he is liked by some people because he's not running around like a maniac, like your Abbie Hoffmans and that. But other people, younger generations, like livelier, more chaotic people, and they would like me more than Eric in my style. You know what I mean?
Yes. Yes. it was just this is really interesting how they lay. What was the layout? What did the layout look like? Because when you described the first one and the second one had just like blank pages with messages. How was this laid out?
This is how like a book page. It's not unusual. It's pretty regular.
Okay.
A lot of print. Okay, and little headlines.
I guess they needed to do that because of the content was really nonlinear, or how they were to do the lesson of.
Well, they were presenting a linear connected bunch of sentences, not aphoristic gaps like the previous edition.
Yes.
Where there's big empty spaces between thoughts. Here they're making a more detailed explanation. Who's playing the piano? I mean, the guitar.
Sarah?
Oh, that's Sarah. Yeah, it's coming out of one of her phone numbers. So, to review, Section 1 didn't have a title. Section 2 had those four themes: all-at-onceness,
eeriness,
discontinuity. Third one was discontinuity and discovery. And then Part 3 didn't have a title, but it went into the details of the phrase, he's heard of hoarding and her faith is altered. And then it goes into the seven themes as they're scattered throughout the book. And then Section 4 is about other art forms, painting, movies, TV, rock music. I'll just read this part. Notice the moving effects the song gets by discontinuity. You have to fill in the remainder of the first two lines, and by the abrupt interface of one culture with another, one emotion, religion, with another, bat upon, ratted upon, one age, early Christianity, with another, ours. Involvement, poignancy, irony, all are heightened. So, there we are. We've